I'm here with John Anderson of the Institute of Communications Research at the University of Illinois. John is a doctoral candidate there examining a technology known now as HD radio. We're going to be talking to him this hour about that technology, about its development, and about its future, such as it may be.
HD radio is actually an amalgam of both analog and digital broadcasting. Just to give you a little piece of history behind this, 20 years ago, other countries in the world began exploring the idea of digitizing their existing terrestrial radio broadcasting systems. And what most countries did is something similar to what the United States did with its digital television transition, in that they found a new piece of spectrum for these broadcasters, and they said, if you want to transition from analog to digital broadcasting, you need to move to this new chunk of spectrum. And so in the United States, that's basically what's happened, and that's also what's happened with digital radio around the rest of the world. And the way digital radio works around the rest of the world is that instead of having one single radio station, like we typically think of, like Cazenovia College has its own radio station. I work for a community radio station. All of the stations in a single geographic area get what they call multiplexed, put on a common transmitter. So they're all broadcasting at the same power and antenna height and coverage area. And then this would involve essentially consumers having to go out and buy whole new radios in order to get this new programming. Originally, the United States was going to buy into this technology, but a couple things happened in the early 90s. The first one was that the spectrum which these other countries were using their digital radio format on was used in the United States by the U.S. military, and the Pentagon at the time was not willing to give up that spectrum. And secondly, after the National Association of Broadcasters, which is the broadcast trade lobby, actually examined HD or digital radio technology, not HD, but this other form of digital radio technology, they didn't like the idea of harmonizing every station. You know, some stations are more powerful than others in the U.S. If you have 50,000 watts, you get out farther typically than a 10,000 watt station. And this would have, you know, equalized the coverage areas of all stations in the U.S. And so for those reasons, the NEB backed away from the technology that the rest of the United or the rest of the world had been using. And in the interim, the FCC went to and told the industry, okay, you guys figure out an alternate way of doing digital radio. In the meantime, we're going to go ahead and we're going to start the satellite audio radio service, Sirius XM. And eventually that was passed and was promulgated and went on the air. And in the meantime, radio broadcasters in the U.S. were trying to figure out, well, how the hell do we actually digitize radio if we're not going to use any of these existing systems? So they came up with this concept called HD radio. And essentially what it is every AM and FM radio station stays on the dial where it exists right now. But in addition to broadcasting their analog signal, there's these two little sidebands that if you think of an analog transmitter or an analog signal as a triangle, and the peak of the triangle is the center of the frequency, there's these two digital sidebands, kind of like saddlebags hanging off the side, and that's the actual digital audio information. And so when people talk about HD radio, they're actually talking about a hybrid analog to digital service. And the problem with this is multiple. The first one is that the way that we set up, you know, how the FCC sets up how many stations can be spaced closely together is a function of analog tradition. And what this company, Ubiquiti Digital Corporation, that is the proprietor and developer of HD radio, said was, we should essentially appropriate spectrum adjacent to existing stations and put the digital signals there. So what HD radio is in the United States is, part one, it's a spectrum grab. It gives all AM and FM radio stations more spectrum on which to broadcast, either in analog or digital. And secondly, the system is totally proprietary. It's software. The CEO of Ubiquiti, Bob Strubel, was very plain, I think in 2003, he went to a broadcasting conference and he said, you know, our business model is Microsoft. If you want to run an HD radio transmitter, you're going to have to buy software from us. You're going to have to license software from us. And that opens up a whole can of worms as to who has control over the airwaves in a digital world. Right now, it's the FCC. You go to them, you get a license, you go on the air. And they're the ones that are publicly responsible for making sure you're doing the right things. But in this new Brave HD world, you need two licenses to broadcast, one from the FCC and another from this private company, which is essentially a software contract agreement. And if you break it, they can break your station. So we don't have truly digital radio in the United States yet. We have a hybrid analog and digital system. And the idea is if enough stations go ahead and transition to a certain point, the marketplace will create a tipping point, and at that point, people will be, compelled to get rid of their old analog receivers, and stations can go totally digital. But that is more than a decade away.
Well,
So.
I was going to suggest that's a model that has been used somewhat successfully in the past. If you look at the transition from black and white to color television, where you had people, continuing to have black and white televisions because the two signals were sent out in a compatible form, over the same set of spectrum. But
Right.
what you're suggesting here, in this case, it's not successful in radio in the same way that it might, at least in retrospect, be seen as successful with television.
Yeah, and the reason why is simply from what you brought up, it's a spectrum allocation issue. What HD radio attempts to do is fit 10 pounds of sand into a 3 pound bag. They've decided that they're going to use the existing analog spectrum and, a couple of kilohertz on each side of every station and put this digital information adjacent to the analog signal. Now, this creates problems. The first one being is that if you're a nearby analog station and your neighbor is running an HD radio signal, their digital sidebands will bleed over into your analog signal, which causes different effects that you can actually hear on an analog radio. And so it causes interference to existing analog stations. On top of that, HD radio signals themselves, the digital parts of an HD radio signal, also have the potential to interfere with the analog part of the signal on the same radio station that's broadcasting in digital. So for example, there's been air checks of DJs who are on the air and they're talking, and one of them starts complaining about this hissing noise that they're hearing. What do you hear that? What's a hissing noise? Let's see if we can find it anywhere. And they finally come to the conclusion, well, that hissing noise is actually the sound of digital information being broadcast underneath the analog sound. And so by adopting digital radio in the United States, we're effectively looking to destroy or denigrate analog service to give digital radio its primary reason to transition. It's almost like, there was that quote from that some army guy said in Vietnam, "We had to destroy the village in order to save it." The radio industry believes that analog radio's future is time limited, and that eventually they're going to go the way of the dinosaur. The identity of what we consider to be radio today has been expanded to include things like podcasting and streaming on demand and satellite radio. If you go in, to example, to a Best Buy or a Costco or a Fry's or any electronic store, and you say, "Show me an HD radio," the clerk is going to point you to Sirius. They're going to point you to the satellite radio, because no one ha the people behind digital radio have done such a terrible marketing job of showing why this technology is important, how it will fundamentally transform AM and FM broadcasting, and why it's important for consumers to adopt it. And that is where the rubber meets the road, is that because the FCC has kind of taken a standoff approach, that they let the industry come up with this HD radio standard on their own. They let a proprietary company whose investors constitute the largest broadcast organizations in the United States develop this technology. They ask no questions about its technical efficiencies. They ask no questions about its wholly proprietary nature. And they've essentially said, "We will let the marketplace decide whether the digital radio transition in the United States succeeds or fails." And if you look at marketplace indicators like the number of stations that are actually broadcasting in HD, or the number of receiver manufacturers that are making HD compatible radios, the trend is not good. The proliferation of HD radio in the United States has actually stalled, and without some sort of financial and political miracle, there is a good chance that this technology will wither and die in the vine, thereby putting the United States back to square one as to what it should be doing about its digital radio transition.
When you're asking people to buy new appliances, stuff like this, an economy like this isn't good for that. And you might say, well, they picked a bad time to do this, except for the fact that HD radio has been around for several years now, and still the last numbers I saw were 1 or 2% of people when surveyed claimed to have HD radios.
Last year, late last year, a company called Bridge Ratings, which does consumer surveys on media consumption, did a survey about digital radio and digital media, digital audio, and how people use digital audio. And they asked the sample, which was 3,000 people, all above the age 13, do you listen to HD radio? And of the survey sample, only 1% of the people reported listening to HD radio on a daily basis. And part of this report also said, well, what is your intent? What is your intent to listen to more of this kind of radio or that kind of radio? And so they looked at HD radio, internet radio, satellite players, terrestrial, analog radio, and satellite radio. And they compared the statistics from their 2006, 2007, and 2009 surveys. Now, according to the trend, the intent to listen more for HD radio and MP3 players and satellite radio are all falling. In 2006, 47% of the people that Bridge Ratings surveyed said they would listen to more HD radio in the future. In 2007, that number was down to 40%. In 2009, that number was down to 37%. However, on the upside, intent to listen to more analog radio has increased. In 2006, 15% of those sampled said they would listen to more analog radio. In 2007, that number went up to 17%. And in 2009, that number's gone up to 20%. So if the industry is trying to digitize terrestrial radio, and listeners do not have an intent to listen to more HD radio in the future, but they want more analog service, then what is the inherent point behind digitizing a service that consumers don't see a fundamental flaw in?
Well, and one of the other things that seems to come out from those numbers, from what I see, is usually when you've got an emerging technology, like perhaps HD radio or like iPods or the like, over time, it's often the case that the percentage of people who say, I plan to adopt or I plan to listen to more of or use more of this technology will drop. But that's usually because many of those people who had planned to in the past have now adopted. In the case of HD radio, it seems people haven't adopted it. And those people, the survey of those people who haven't yet adopted, so some of them would have said a few years ago, yes, I will listen to it in the future, but they've now changed their minds, rather than being that they've become users and therefore not part of this, I plan to start listening in the future. That's exactly. Unusual and not a healthy place for a technology to be.
Exactly, and if you look also at the numbers of stations that are actually converting to digital radio, or HD radio, I guess we can call it, because it's not truly digital, the number of stations that have converted over the past 3 years has been slowly trending downward. So we have sluggish marketplace momentum on two very key aspects of the transition. One, on the side of the broadcasters who have to make these signals available to entice consumers to go out and buy digital radios. And on the other hand, you have receiver manufacturers who are not willing to invest in and supply cheap receivers to entice consumers to listen. And when consumers actually get a chance to listen to HD radio, they're completely underwhelmed. It does not bring anything fundamentally new to the broadcast industry or to the broadcasting experience. All it is right now is simply a digitized version of a station's main analog channel. Now, there is a feature in HD radio called multicasting, which is only applicable to the FM side of the technology, where a station could essentially break up their digital sidebands into two or three chunks, and each chunk would represent its own program stream. So if you had an HD radio, you could tune into frequency X, and it might have two other channels, like say it's a country station. Maybe it's HD 2 channel, which would only be broadcast in digital, might be young country. And its HD 3 channel might be classic country, right? And so that gives you some sort of idea that HD radio has the potential to increase marketplace choice. But the problem is that the technology doesn't work. When you put your sidebands on the air, you inherently cause interference to neighboring stations who don't like you when you do that. And you also run the risk of interfering with your existing analog radio system. And people that have actually been early adopters and bought digital radios are finding the same problems they found with digital TV. You know, people went out and bought these hugely expensive digital televisions, and then they realized, holy crap, we have to put up rabbit ears in order to get the signal. You know, we have to revert back to a 1970s era technology in order to get a 21st century broadcast quality signal, because digital TV underperformed. It's the same thing with digital radio. If you listen to it in a car, it's all right. But if you listen to it in a house, you're lucky to actually get a digital signal, because the relative power of those digital sidebands are so small that they can't penetrate walls.
Let's explain a little more in detail, perhaps, for listeners. You'd mentioned earlier that this being a spectrum grab, and mm-hmm. you talked there about neighboring stations being unhappy.
Your typical FM analog station takes up 200 kilohertz of space. That's why the dials always end in odd numbers. So there's like 90.1, 90.3, 90.5, 90.7, 90.9. Because the center frequency of an analog station is on that even or on that odd number. So for example, my community radio station WEFT in Champaign broadcasts on 90.1. But its spectral footprint actually extends from 90.0 to 90.2, right? But we listen on 90.1 because that's the middle of the frequency. Now what HD radio does is it essentially adds on the edges of that analog footprint two digital sidebands, each of which effectively double the footprint of the extant radio station. So for example, if WEFT was broadcasting in HD, instead of taking up 200 kilohertz of space with a signal, they'd be taking up 430 kilohertz. 200 kilohertz of that towards their existing analog signal, and 130 kilohertz or 65 kilohertz on each side of the signal for their digital stuff. So essentially, they've increased their footprint on the dial without going through an auction process, without this actually being considered a spectrum allocation deal. I'm reading the FCC files on this, and it's really interesting the rhetoric that they use. They said, we're going to be able to digitize radio in this way because it uses no new spectrum. And they, without getting into too much detail, basically rhetorically twisted technical definitions of what spectrum meant in order to appropriate spectrum nearby every existent radio station.
So, and at the moment, so if you've got the example of WEFT again, 90.1, mm-hmm. analog runs 90.0 to 90.2. If they had digital, they'd be running from 89.9 up to 90.3.
Right.
As it is, the FCC usually won't put a station on the 89.9 point. But when you're there, you're hitting against the edges of a another station. If you've got two digital stations, their digital signals could be overlapping, or you could have you could be butting up against the side of an analog signal. If I understand what you're saying correctly.
Yes. For example, there's another station in town here, Mix 94.5. I can't remember what its call letters are, but they're one of the few stations in Champaign-Urbana that's actually broadcasting in HD. And I do a radio show on Tuesday nights, and one of the ways I prepare is I take my Walkman and I do a little band scan to listen to what's going on the airwaves over the course of the evening. And if you tune into 94.5, starting at about 94.8, you begin to hear this recurrent pulsation noise. It's a buzzing noise. It kind of goes, and then the closer you tune to 94.5, the more you actually hear the signal. And then the farther away you go from 94.5 on the other side, that buzzing noise comes back in. That buzzing noise is the digital sideband of that station, but I can hear it, you know, three clicks away on the dial.
But you're not hearing audio, you're hearing digital static, essentially.
I'm hearing digital, you know, pulsating digital information. And if I was trying to listen to a station, say, on 94.1, even the way, you know, this particular station has implemented it very sloppily. They haven't done a very good job of making sure that the spectral integrity of their system is tight. So they bleed, you know, over almost, you know, a full megahertz. They're at 94.5, and I can hear their digital hash all the way out to 94.9 and 93.9. That's wrong. Because all the stations in between are getting screwed. Now, let's say there's a station on 94.1 that's not local to Champaign, but I can usually hear it on my analog radio. Well, with the imposition of digital radio nearby to that frequency, suddenly I lose access to a radio station. And the FCC calls this progress. They say that, yes, some listeners are going to lose access to some radio stations, and this is going to be a lot more dramatically seen on the AM side than on the FM side, but the mantra is the potential risks of losing stations, listening to stations due to interference, is worth the reward of our digital utopia.
Several things come out of that. One is, you know, you mentioned utopia, utopian thinking. There's kind of often with digital technologies, over the last while, there's been kind of a technophilia, that a sense that if it's digital, it must be better. If it's digital,
absolutely,
it must be desirable.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you can look back at every single form of traditional media, and you can look at the way that they have navigated this phenomenon that we call convergence. For example, newspapers. Newspapers navigating themselves onto the web or onto mobile phone application devices are not replicating themselves as newspapers online. See what I'm saying? They're basically becoming web editions of their existent product, but they're not newspapers on the web. It's a newspaper's website. Same thing for digital television. We were promised that it was going to add, you know, incredible quality and, you know, this wonderful fidelity to pictures. I don't have digital cable or digital television in my home, but I've gone to my parents' house and I've seen digital cable, and it sucks. When you're watching something, suddenly the picture will stop, or it'll pixelate because the network is congested. We're back in the old days with analog. Maybe you'd get some fuzz here and there, but you'd still be able to see a legible picture. Same thing with the digital phones. Remember analog cellular telephony? You'd go through kind of a dead or weak spot, and you'd hear crackle, crackle, pop, pop, but then you'd fade out of it, and suddenly the call would be clear again. Now, when you get into a dead zone, the call is dropped. And with radio, no one has come up with a logical rationale for why this particular traditional mass media should be digitized. You know, I really think that, you know, in the case of radio especially, it's really a question of what is the point? Is the point to follow this mythical trend of convergence, and that if you're not digital by a certain point, you're a dinosaur? Or are we looking to digitize because it will be inherently better for the functionality of the medium? And the answer to that question is the former, not the latter. It's digitalizations for digitalization's sake, and consequences be damned. And as a person who loves radio, that scares the hell out of me. And that's why I'm, you know, writing a dissertation about it. But there's one other point that I wanted to make. And that is that even though the United States has taken its own route to digital radio, and we're using a technology that no other country except the Philippines and Panama have adopted, every single other digital radio technology that is in existence is also failing. Like I said, a lot of the countries in Europe that went with this different digital radio system that involved multiplexing, they put these networks on the air 10 years ago, and they're finding that consumers don't care. They still listen to analog radio. France and Germany are both considering shutting down their national digital audio broadcasting networks because the marketplace has rejected it as not being a good enough improvement to existing analog service.
Or attractive enough to undergo migration. I think, right. as I understand it, the UK is really one of the few countries that has committed themselves wholeheartedly from a regulatory perspective to migrating to the DAB standard, Digital Audio Broadcasting Standard.
Which is completely now being rethought by Ofcom. It's come up in questions in Parliament. Why should we be doing this if we're not getting the kind of receiver penetration that we want? We're not serving the kind of audience that we serve with our analog signal. You're right. The UK, I believe, is the only country that I know of that set a analog digital radio transition deadline for something like 2015. Mm-hmm. And they've written a white paper saying, you know, once we go digital, how do we repurpose the AM and FM analog spectrum? But I'm telling you, Andrew, that that's going to get pushed back because even, like I said, in the UK and other European countries, the trajectory of adoption, both by broadcasters and by listeners, is going down. So mm-hmm. the problem with the digitalization of radio is not a technological foundational problem. The problems with adoption of digital radio, the problems with its increased functionality to entice new listeners to upgrade and take advantage, these problems are technologically agnostic. What I'm saying is no one's come up with a terrestrial digital radio broadcast standard that us, the listenership of the world, cares about and is willing to invest in.
That's a problem.
One
of the technologies I think we've talked about before briefly that I always think of when I think of the digitization of radio is the RDS standard, I think Radio Data Service or something of that nature, which allows transmission, as a sideband on an analog signal, of certain pieces of data like weather forecasts, traffic information, usually
artist and song titles.
Exactly, and that's been used to some effect in Europe. It's one of the ways that, say, stations are able to add tags saying news bulletin starting now, and radio sets in cars will often, you know, be scanning the dial and will pick up and switch automatically to a station with a news bulletin if you preset that to happen. But that's something that, on the one hand, never took off here, but also has minimal impact as a technology. This is at this stage, a 30-year-old plus technology, but
yeah.
does much of what people are touting as the, I suppose, the killer apps that that digital radio might provide.
Oh, sure. Like, for example, there's existing supplementary digital radio technologies that exist, which can essentially allow a station to add, you know, some sort of digital content. The one that you're thinking of is RDS. I'm thinking of a company called FM Extra, which is a digital audio content service provider that's come up with a protocol that doesn't require a wholesale reformatting and reconstruction of the air chain. And you're absolutely right. All the things that HD radio is promising us, artist and song title information, station IDs, traffic and weather alerts, things like this, are already, you know, we can already do them using existing technologies that do not kill, but rather, you know, actively and proactively supplement analog radio. The problem with these technologies is that they haven't been built in as standard options in receivers, right? If you want to go get an RDS-enabled receiver, you got to go find it. You got to hunt for it. Because, as you've said here, not many stations in the U.S. have adopted it, and so consumer, you know, radio manufacturers have not made it a standard part of their radio receivers. And so a lot of the promises of HD radio are essentially, yeah, in a lot of ways, rehashes of existing supplements to analog technologies. And some of the pie-in-the-sky things that they're talking about that may be useful have not come to pass. For example, Apple... A couple months ago, I think, came out with the new iPod Nano, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the new iPod Nano includes an FM receiver in it. And it also includes the functionality of recording up to 15 minutes of FM programming to play back at your leisure, right? But it's not HD compatible. You can record the analog signal and play it back at your leisure. But Apple has decided that there is no point in building HD compatibility or functionality into our applications. So if you've got companies like Apple that are not willing to put HD radio functionality into their devices, if you have car manufacturers who are not willing to put HD radio as standard equipment in their cars, how are you going to entice listeners to begin to adopt this technology? It just isn't happening.
One of the things, so you're looking at, you've talked about some of the issues with the technology that, to a certain extent, it seems to be very much botched as a technological development in engineering terms. But you also mentioned early on that this is a proprietary standard. This differs from amplitude modulation, frequency modulation, AM and FM, which are the two analog standards that people will primarily be familiar with, where you don't need to go and pay money to what used to be RCA, or you don't need to go pay money to the Marconi company as it used to be,
right,
in order to make use of either of these technologies. What, to your mind, and I think you mentioned you drew attention to the fact that the company that owns Ubiquiti, many of the shareholders in that are major commercial players in the radio broadcast market.
Mm-hmm.
What has that aspect of things, how has that played into the development and also the push for regulatory decisions with HD radio in the US?
All right, well, first of all, this kind of proprietary system is unprecedented in the world of broadcasting. Now, for example, you know, when you buy a radio or when a company buys a transmitter, there are certain components within the transmitter that have patents attached to them. And the cost of paying to utilize that technology is built into the cost of the purchase price of the hardware. But it's a one-time fee, right? So you pay 5 cents, you know, to RCA because you're using some widget that they invented 60 years ago, and that's it. And RCA gets a little cut, and that's fine. But in this case, every single person in the communicative chain has to pay to play. So if you're a broadcaster, not only do you have to go out and buy, you know, an HD radio compatible transmitter, but then you have to buy the software from Ubiquiti for $10,500, one-time fee, in order to run the software. When Ubiquiti comes out with upgrades, kind of like Windows does, you know, from Windows 98 to Windows 2K to what, you know, XP, they're going to charge you to upgrade to the new software. If you use some of the value-added features, like multicasting, if you're a commercial radio station and you decide to split your FM stream up into three different channels, and you run advertising on those multicast channels, Ubiquiti requires you to give them a cut of your revenue.
So they not only are they getting flat fees, you mentioned $10,500 as a flat fee for
right,
buying the software. They're looking for a percentage. They're looking, as you say, for a percentage cut of your revenue from use of the software.
Right, recurrent fees for usage of the features. And so a receiver manufacturer has to license the chipset and the software to put into its radio. And so there will be a built-in cost for licensing that will be passed on to the consumer. In the transmitter side of things, when Ubiquiti first introduced its licensing scheme, I think back in like 2005, maybe it was, originally, the one-time cost for early adopters was $25,000, and Ubiquiti said, "Well, if you adopt, you know, 5 years from now, it's actually going to go up." And what's actually happened is they've cut their licensing fees in half which I think says something about the adoption trend of the technology. But at a local Society of Broadcast Engineers meeting, I think in Oklahoma, an engineer was quoted as saying, when the ubiquity licensing fees were announced, the news went through the room like wind, as if someone had cut the cheese, meaning they were shocked, they were blown away by the fact that the FCC and the broadcast industry in general was essentially willing to turn the entire industry into sharecroppers for a proprietary digital broadcast system. Now, the FCC on this side, this has been brought up, you know, independent broadcasters, broadcasters who have not invested in ubiquity, have brought up the notion of this proprietary software and how it works. The fact that the standard for HD radio, all of the reference technical reference documents are not publicly available because some of them create trade secrets, or some of them contain trade secrets. Because even those who are going to be implementing this technology are not privy to the way it actually works, that is, you know, leaving a bad taste in people's mouths. Now, the FCC turns around and says, well, we have a precedent for this. Back in 1964, we wrote a document on the use of patented technologies. And we're going to use what we defined as acceptable metrics for open sourcing or you know, licensing your technologies in order to follow whether or not ubiquity is abusing its intellectual property position. Now, the funny thing about this document is that it was written before computer software existed. So how can you take a document which is referring to patented technologies more generally, but it doesn't refer to the whole new intricate cans of worms that are brought up by concepts like software licensing? And so the FCC is basically pulling a laissez-faire. They're saying, unless ubiquity goes into the market like Godzilla and starts twisting everybody's arms and saying, pay up or we'll kneecap you, the FCC really doesn't care. And that is a shame as well. All they're saying is, well, we'll promise to keep an eye on them, you know. Don't worry, we'll keep an eye on them, and we believe ubiquities. You know, they've told us that they're going to play ball, and we believe them. We trust them. So just, you know, chill out about that. Just hang loose and see how it goes. We don't think there's going to be a problem. You know, and I don't buy that.
Well, one of the problems with that approach is that if you have that laissez-faire approach and you're waiting for Godzilla to happen, well, you only notice that after Godzilla comes in and destroys all the furniture in the room. You know, radio, in overall listenership numbers, you know, still I think it's something like 92% of the population or so listening to it, but has been seeing, you know, somewhat of a decline, there has been a sense of vulnerability. And so if you, particularly given the fact that there are so many other spaces where people can get entertainment or information from, if you're waiting to see, you know, oh look, the radio industry has been destroyed, surely that, you know, that's perhaps waiting a little bit too long.
It's one of these old adages that you know, both you and I know really well, and that's that the pace of technology development often outpaces the pace of regulation of that technology development. We've seen it over and over and over again. We're seeing it right now in the debates over network neutrality, right? We're spending all this time in D.C. trying to get bills passed to make sure that telecommunications companies are not discriminating against your access to certain content on the Internet. Well, while we're having this nice little discussion, chatty chat in D.C., Comcast, now called Xfinity, and Verizon and AT&T are going ahead and implementing network management software that effectively discriminates against the content that you can see. So by the time the lawmakers and the regulators get around to figuring out that they've let the cat out the bag, the cat is long gone. And the same thing is happening with digital radio. And in part of this, you know, I really have to critique the new Obama FCC on this. I mean, digital radio and the rulemaking that I'm studying right now began in November 1st of 1999. and they are still deliberating the final rules for HD radio and its proliferation in the United States. That in itself says something about the technology's weaknesses. Now we have this brand new FCC. We no longer got Michael Powell and Kevin Martin and people who are all about the deregulatory this and the deregulatory that, and it's marketplace or bust. Now we have some progressives, so to speak, on the FCC. The chairman, Julius Genachowski, has been talking really good about broadband and open access to broadband. But the agency's focus is totally on broadband now, to the detriment of recognizing and regulating or attempting to regulate the problems that exist in traditional media. No one's talking about the death of newspapers. No one's talking about the stumbled transition of HDTV. Public interest obligations for HD television broadcasters haven't even been developed. That should have been done 15 years ago. But it's on the FCC's back burner. And so as far as HD radio is concerned, if I met Julius Genachowski in a bar and walked up to him and said, "Hi, Chairman, I'd like to ask you about HD radio," he'd probably look at me and say, "What are you talking about?" Because it is simply not a concern among the regulatory echelon, which allows a lot of space for incumbent broadcasters, which happen to be the main investors in this technology, to go ahead and implement it in a way that they think is going to be strategically most advantageous to them. And I'm saying the marketplace, and I hate saying marketplace forces will decide things, but in this case, that will be the case. The FCC is going to let HD radio either succeed or hang on its own. The FCC is not going to implement a hard deadline for digital radio. Do you know why? Because 48 of the 50 state broadcasters associations in the United States do not want to be forced to upgrade all of their member stations to HD radio. There is an incredible amount of pushback within the broadcast industry against this technology. And the only people who are cheering for it are those who have invested in the technology. When Clear Channel spends $10,500 or $25,000 to license one of its radio stations to broadcast an HD radio, a cut of that money comes back to Clear Channel because they're equity investors in Ubiquiti, see? So they're paying themselves. And ultimately, you could look at this as a scheme by which large broadcast conglomerates, using a technological tool, will essentially turn the rest of independent radio into their own sharecroppers by making them pay for a license fee to use a technology.
One of the you mentioned how much HD radio has been on the back burner, and to a certain extent, that can be seen both, it's been left to hang around without taking hard decisions one way or the other, which shows a lack of commitment, a lack of investment of both willpower and thought in the process, but also can be seen sometimes as having the advantage of not forcing a cutoff date for analog radio, which would, in my opinion, be disastrous for the industry. But one of the things that I understand the FCC has recently engaged in is to approve further power increases for these digital sidebands that HD radio consists of. Could you perhaps give a little bit of information to our listeners on what's involved in that process?
Sure. AM HD radio and FM HD radio, essentially operate in the same way in that there's an analog signal in the middle and then there's these digital saddlebags on the side. And AM HD is a whole different can of worms, technologically speaking. It's not working, and there has to be some significant redesigns. But on the FM side, how the technology was rolled out was a station could broadcast these digital sidebands, but they had to be at 1/100th of the power level of the analog signal. So, for example, WEFT, the station that I volunteer for, is a 10,000-watt station, right? Which means that if we wanted to go HD and buy a transmitter and get a license from Ubiquiti, we would be able to broadcast 100 watt digital sidebands. This is part of the way by which the developers of Ibiquity and the FCC have determined that this is the most effective way of mitigating interference between stations, is by making sure that the digital signals are essentially whispers in power comparison to the analog signals. Well, what they discovered is when they started rolling these stations out that a digital signal at 1/100 the power of an analog signal does not travel as far, nor is it as easily listenable to as a full power analog signal. And that's one of the reasons why the stagnation of the adoption of HD radio by FM broadcasters has occurred. So Ibiquity and a lot of the major broadcasting groups like Clear Channel and CBS Radio, a couple of years back, applied to the FCC and said, you know, this whole idea of broadcasting at this lower power level in the real world, it's not working. We told you it was going to work. We created scientific documents and maps that showed that this would work. But now that we've actually put these stations out there on the air, we're finding that digital coverage is abysmal. So what we want to do is we want to increase the power of our digital sidebands by a factor of 10. So instead of broadcasting, like if I was WEFT, instead of broadcasting with a 100 watt digital signal, I can now broadcast with a 1,000 watt digital signal, right? And the idea is that maybe this will entice more broadcasters to adopt HD radio because it will make the coverage of digital signals much more robust. But by doing so, you increase the potential for not only interference to nearby stations by raising the power on the edges of your spectral footprint, right? But you also create the potential to interfere with the analog host signal. There's a guy by the name of Doug Vernier who runs a consulting service called VSoft. And National Public Radio, it was actually one of the entities behind pushing for this digital radio, this FM digital radio power hike. And he wrote the technological prospectus, you know, for this study. And the study got done in, I think, December of 2007, and a front page article appeared in Radio World Engineering Extra, and it was written by none other than Doug Vernier. And the headline was, "What are we doing to ourselves exactly?" And what he said was, if we up the power of FM digital sidebands, not only are we going to create interference with neighboring stations, but we're also going to create more self-interference.
Wait, so
And
this is
even though the guy behind developing this study has come out publicly and said this is a bad idea, enough other companies like Ibiquity, like Clear Channel, like CBS have gone to their own engineers to create rebuttal studies. And then then you go to the FCC, and here's these poor staffers who are basically looking at piles. Which pile is bigger? You
Well,
know?
and so much regulation, particularly in a situation like this, where you've got large, well-financed and powerful entities that stand to make a big payoff on this, regulation can come down to that thing of make sure that if there's a big pile, that throw them at least a bone. You have essentially regulatory capture through lobbying, through engineering, finance.
And also you have regulatory capture through a phenomenon which J.H. Snyder, who used to work for the New America Foundation and did a lot of work on digital television, you have a phenomenon calling he calls the creation of facts on the ground. So for example, when digital radio was still in its infancy, the FCC basically told stations, if you want to play with this experiment with this technology, just let us know and we'll give you an experimental authorization to do this. And the station takes that experimental authorization and expands upon it, extends upon what they've been allowed to do to try new functions and features and things like that. And then if they find that something works, they get another experimental authorization for another radio station and try it in that. in that market and see if it works. And then suddenly you have 300 radio stations all operating under experimental authorization, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the industry can turn around and say, well, look, there's all these stations on the air that are already doing what we want you to give us permission to do. Mm-hmm. Why? What right do you have to take back something that we're already doing? And it's a very common regulatory practice. It's called creation of facts on the ground. Look, we're doing this, so why not just make it legal?
It reminds me of the old adage about it being better to seek forgiveness than permission. Go do what you want to do, and then it'll be, as you say, there'll be facts on the ground. People will be able, you'll be able to point and say, do you want to stop us doing that? Rather than, please let us look for one or two or whatever number of permissions.
Right. You know, that happened with multicasting. It happened with the power increase that we just talked about. You know, some of the stations that were really pushing for the power increase went to the FCC and said, we want to do a station in, Richmond, Virginia. We want to try this. And the FCC said, okay, sign a little form. And then the company goes back and says, oh, we want to try this again with the station in Cleveland, Ohio. And the FCC says, okay. And suddenly the company comes back and files comments in the rulemaking saying, based on the fact that 20 of our radio stations are successfully doing this, we think you should make it a blanket authorization. And there's no peer review. There's no opportunity to independently evaluate the results of these quote-unquote tests and experiments.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that a former FCC Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein called a faith-based regulation, in that it's not really about whether this is scientifically or engineeringly feasible. It's about whether or not the political constituencies behind it are strong enough to basically shout down any sort of dissent. And if that's possible, then the FCC is going to go with the one that's got the biggest pockets and the biggest voice.
You know, I'm reminded, and it's probably, it could be an entire other conversation, but I'm reminded in contrast of the process around LPFM, where the large broadcasters wanted to, the FCC was considering and was planning to bring in a low-power FM service in order to open up new licensing opportunities. The large broadcasters did not want it to happen, and they brought their lobbying power, their ability to churn out large reports and
junk science,
and also then to go to Congress when the FCC didn't, in that case, didn't bow down to it totally, and to push for Congress to strike the FCC rules on that.
Mm-hmm. And that's ironic because you know, the National Association of Broadcasters and National Public Radio claimed that by putting these little 100-watt analog LPFM stations on the air, this would cause oceans of interference, which is you know, technically not true. If I'm a 100-watt station and you're a 10,000-watt station and we're nearby each other on the dial, I am going to receive interference from you because you are 100 times stronger than me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, digital radio essentially increases the footprint of every single radio station on the dial, AM and FM both, thereby creating much more potential for interference than LPFM stations. And when the FCC gave the go-ahead on, I think it was in the end of February, end of January, last Friday in January,
mm-hmm.
they said, you know, people had commented and said, don't you realize that if you do this, every single radio station that broadcasts in HD will be broadcasting with a digital signal, which is stronger, more powerful than an analog LPFM station. Every single full-power radio station will be able to broadcast, I just want to say that again, with a digital signal that is more powerful than any LPFM station can be.
And these are the same entities that had claimed these 100-watt or 10-watt stations would cause such interference.
And so people said, like in the rulemaking before the FCC came out with this, they're like, you know, watch out, you know, this is really going to hurt low-power FM radio stations because, first of all, If you're a 100-watt radio station, even under these new rules, if you wanted to adopt HD radio, the strongest signal you could broadcast with digitally is 10 watts.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no economic or functional reason, or logical reason for that matter, for LPFM stations to adopt HD radio. And the FCC has said, well, because LPFM is a secondary service and must receive interference from full power radio stations, and since HD radio is simply an extension of our full power radio station regulatory policy, you guys are just out of luck. You know? And not only that, but they also said that if you find interference, you know, caused by neighbors on the dial that are using HD radio, in order for us, the FCC, to take those interference complaints seriously, and I'm reading from the document,
mm-hmm.
your complaint must contain at least 6 reports of ongoing rather than transitory objectionable interference. For each report, the affected FM licensee must submit a map showing the location of the reported interference and a detailed description of the nature and extent of the interference. It also must contain a complete description of the tests and equipment used to identify the alleged interference and the scope of the unsuccessful efforts to resolve the interference. Meaning that if you have a problem with HD radio putting chowder on your own station signal, you have to go through an incredibly large set of hoops in order for the FCC to take your interference complaint seriously. And that flips the whole spectral regulatory paradigm on its head. Historically, whenever the FCC's come out with a new service, whether it be UHF television or FM broadcasting or digital subcarriers for radio, the adage is first do no harm. Put this new service on the air, but in doing so, we have to make sure that it doesn't interfere with existing users of that spectrum. In this case, the FCC has flipped the paradigm, and they've said, we don't care that digital radio may inherently decimate the choice that listeners have in the analog realm. We're just going to go we're going to go digital or broke. So for a small independent radio station like a community radio station, an LPFM radio station, do you think they're going to actually have the time and the willpower and the volunteer efforts needed to collect at least 6 reports with maps and extensive documentation? No. We're just going to have to suffer the interference.
You know, and it seems that's so much at odds with the FCC's usual approach to not soliciting, but allowing complaints and queries from members of the public about
right.
radio stations, and also seems to treat that the people who are to complain are the other radio station. If you're a listener who's trying to tune into a community radio station, they're saying, you know, they're not going to consider a complaint from you as a member of the public about the misuse of the spectrum. They're going to require you go to the community station, who then need to collate that with 5 other reports before they can move up the chain with it.
Right. To put it very simply, the past regulatory history of the FCC has always put the onus of resolving interference complaints on the interferer. The station that is causing interference. So if you get a broadcast license, one of the unspoken obligations that comes with getting a broadcast license is that you promise to not interfere with your neighbors on the dial. But in this case, the FCC says the burden of proof is on the victim. The burden of proof that there's actually a problem here is not on the station causing the interference, it's on the station receiving the interference. And you're saying to me, like, yeah, so if you're a listener and you suddenly find interference, are you educated enough to know what kind of interference that is? Have we, as scholars and as public interest policymaker type people, have we educated the community to know what digital radio interference sounds like? No. They're first either going to think their radio is broken or there's a problem with the station they're listening to.
And
so what is the chance of a listener actually, you know, finding out the protocol to file a complaint on this digital radio rulemaking? It totally cuts the public out of having any sense of agency in rectifying any interference concerns. And like I said, it puts the onus on the victim to
mm-hmm.
prove that an interference problem exists. And that's not the way the FCC has ever run spectrum management, ever.